This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. That's Taps, being played at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Washington, D.C., where President Joe Biden laid a wreath this morning. In a ceremony after, President Biden offered this reflection.
To be a veteran is to have endured and survived challenges most Americans will never know. You've come through the trials and testing, brave dangers and deprivations, face down tragic realities of war and death. You've done it for us. You've done it for America.
Just one of many ceremonies and observances today of Veterans Day. And we're glad that you've joined us to mark the sacrifices and the service of the men and women of our armed forces. In Massachusetts, Governor Baker marked Veterans Day at a ceremony at Boston's Faneuil Hall, where he talked about the sacrifices of veterans and why they make them.
It's love of their country. It's love of their family who may have served in the military. It's love of their friends who choose to serve in the military. It's love of that man or woman who's standing next to you in basic training.
This is the first Veterans Day in 20 years where the U.S. is not at war. We left Afghanistan in August. That conflict still echoes deeply for our nation, however, as do all those before it that left our veterans wounded, and the victories throughout generations that have helped us remain stable and free. A little later in the hour, we will revisit a conversation with two state representatives with deep connections to this day. One served in Afghanistan, the other lost his son in battle and is now part of a Gold Star family. Then we travel all the way back to 9/11 and the memoir of Virginia Buckingham, who was in charge of Logan Airport that day and has battled public and private demons in the years since. We'd like to start, though, with Congressman Jake Auchincloss of the Massachusetts 4th District. He served in Afghanistan as a young Marine. And along with fellow Massachusetts Congressman and former Marine Seth Moulton, he advocates extensively for veterans issues. We caught up with Auchincloss as he was traveling earlier this afternoon and asked him what he thinks about on this day and what he needs as a veteran from his community.
I am leaving now the Draper Memorial Park in Milford, one of the towns in the Massachusetts 4th, where I saw a marker that said 34 miles to Boston, 1773. It's a marker from the Minutemen who were assembling to train in preparation for the Revolutionary War. And it's a reminder to me of how longstanding and deep-rooted Massachusetts' commitment to armed service is when necessary to defend our rights and liberties. What I need as a public servant, as a veteran, is for we in the Commonwealth to reflect on this day about why we fight and the core American ideals that we fight to defend: liberty, equal opportunity under law, justice. That's what makes this meaningful to me.
Why did you fight?
Like many big decisions, it is multi-threaded. I fought because I wanted to challenge myself, like many young people do. I fought because this country was engaged in two wars overseas, but too few Americans were actually committing themselves to them. And I fought out of respect for loved ones who had served before me. Like many of our listeners, I have loved ones who served in World War II. My two grandfathers, both from very different walks of life, put the uniform on, pushed pause on their livelihoods, put their lives at risk. My mom's dad was the son of refugees fleeing the Russian pogroms. He had no prospects until the Marine Corps sent him to college. My dad's father was more well-to-do, the son of doctors who in other times may not have needed to serve, but they both put the uniform on. And it was a unifying moment for this country. For decades afterwards, that shared service and sacrifice in World War II informed, and I think enriched, our civil and political discourse. We're so hungry for that now as a country. We're so divided. We talk to each other in such vitriolic terms. And reminding ourselves of shared service and having veterans be a lodestar for that, I think, is very healthy for our body politic.
Thinking of veterans as a lodestar, you met with veterans in Milford this week. What did they tell you?
Well, they shared individual struggles in getting the care and support that they deserve and need from the federal government. But broadly speaking, the message I took away is the importance of treating the whole veteran. It's not just a single casework issue. It's not just about, you know, this order or this check. When a veteran comes in contact with a government agency, let's use that as an opportunity to try to treat a whole range of issues that they may be confronting, whether mental health or physical health or even social isolation. I think, for example, of a Boston VA hospital that I visited that now has a wing dedicated exclusively to women veterans, which is an increasing phenomenon now from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and increased service from women. This is a wing of the hospital dedicated solely to the needs of women veterans and treating as much as possible the whole person, not just their acute physical condition at the time.
I want to stay on that for a minute. The VA is one of the government agencies most responsible for supporting our veterans. You're in favor of some legislation right now, for example, to better cover care for the health impacts of burn pits and other exposures to carcinogens. Are we doing right by our veterans with VA? And what do you want to see there?
The VA does important and noble work. And I don't like it when politicians treat it like a punching bag to score political points. Can we always be doing more? Yes, of course we can. When I was in Afghanistan, we burned tons of stuff. And in retrospect, those burn pits certainly gave off toxins that we needed to be more cognizant of. As the science improves, as our understanding of toxins in both water and air gets more sophisticated, we need to update our coverage to respect the fact that if people were exposed to carcinogens, that we make them whole for that exposure.
What could we do better right now in honoring our veterans, supporting our veterans, that might actually bring us together better as a country?
I think elevating veterans' voices in our civil and political discourse, hearing them on issues that are both about foreign policy and armed services, but also issues that are just contentious. Veterans have a muscle memory for how to work together in pursuit of a common mission, putting aside disagreements. We had a saying in the Marine Corps that you disagree and commit, that behind the line of departure, you wanted to have vigorous debate within the platoon about tactics. But once you cross that line of departure, you've got to be unified. And that's a spirit that really needs to embed itself more in a broader range of issues. But right now, there are fewer veterans in Congress than I think at any time since World War II. And getting more veterans in Congress, is it by itself going to heal our politics? No, of course not. It's more complicated than that. But I do think it'll help.
I want to pick up now on Afghanistan. You had a really powerful conversation here on Radio Boston back in August as the nation was leaving Afghanistan. I want to ask you, we've got some hindsight now on that time and the months since then. How have the efforts gone? Do you approve of what the country did the way they did it?
I continue to support the president's decision to withdraw. It was a high integrity decision. It was a hard decision. There was no glory in it, but he put the interests of the nation first. Ultimately, we are going to be judged by three things in terms of the success of Afghanistan. One is whether we're able to sustain basic humanitarian protections for the Afghan people. They are facing a winter of privation and starvation and exposure, and we need to get humanitarian aid to those people independent of politics. Number two, whether we're able to prevent Afghanistan from devolving into a narco-terror state. The trafficking in meth could potentially fuel the rise of ISIS-K and Taliban collaborating on terrorist training camps. We must not allow that to happen. And number three, whether we are able to elbow out China's designs on the rare earth minerals that exist in Afghanistan in great quantities, and that Chinese hegemony over those minerals would allow them a stranglehold on the supply chain of copper and rare earth minerals that's really unacceptable for geostrategic purposes. Those are the three things that are going to define success for us in the decade ahead.
What about efforts to get allies out of the country? How have we done there? Are we doing enough? Is it over? What else do we need to do?
The administration orchestrated the greatest airlift in modern history to get 120,000 Afghans out. Most of them had served alongside Americans, and we should be proud of that effort. We are not done with that effort. We need to ensure that those who are in harm's way from Taliban reprisal, that their safety and their family's safety is protected. I also want to reflect on the efforts here in Massachusetts and across the nation to welcome those refugees from Afghanistan. I think in speaking with nonprofits and faith traditions throughout the Commonwealth who are welcoming these refugees, it just reflects the best of who we are in the Bay State. We are welcoming these folks with open arms. We're trying to ensure that they get off to a good start in their new home. And it is an element of this withdrawal that I think we should celebrate and focus on.
I hear your focus. I hear your optimism. I hear your clarity on what you think the next policy issues are. There is a piece of me that wants to ask you, is there nothing in the last few months that's made you angry about Afghanistan?
Well, there's been elements of Afghanistan that have made me angry since I was there as a second lieutenant in 2012. And that is to say that national security leadership in Washington allowed sunk cost bias to guide our decision making. We sunk more troops, more time, more treasure into a counterinsurgency mission that could not succeed. And it was not because there were not smart people in the national security room who knew better. It was because senior decision makers lacked the moral courage to tell the American people a hard truth about whether this war could be won or not. This president deserves credit for finally having the courage to tell that hard truth to Americans.
You know, you have called for a full congressional investigation into the Afghanistan war, start to end. I feel like that's part of what I'm hearing from you right there. Any updates on the status of that?
We are working hard now as a start to declassify high-level strategic memoranda about the Afghan conflict. And we're also going to be working with the Special Inspector General's Office for Afghanistan Reconstruction that really did the most comprehensive retrospective on decision-making. And Saigar revealed, frankly, that key people have always known that our mission there was broken. And yet it was never translated into public-facing commentary. And there needs to be accountability for that.
What about the Taliban? Over the last few months, as we've begun to see their rule take shape, what are you observing? What are you watching? What are your responses early on?
I go back to our three core missions in Afghanistan. It is to elbow out China's designs on rare earth mining. It is securing basic humanitarian protections, and it's preventing Afghanistan from devolving into a narco-terror state. The Taliban has a monopoly on the use of organized violence in Afghanistan right now. That means they are the institution that the United States needs to be working with or around to secure those three aims. And they are a brutal regime. They are not the regime that we would have chosen to run that country. They're not a regime that I would want to raise my family under. But the thing about diplomacy is that you don't get to pick the people you're talking to. You do have to work with your enemies to accomplish these aims. That is particularly acute right now for the humanitarian protections. We cannot use humanitarian aid as a lever right now for every single thing we may want to accomplish in Afghanistan, because the Afghan people are facing privation this winter and they need the help now.
Before we let you go, I just want to ask you, because it is Veterans Day, what will be the single best part of your day today?
Oh, it's seeing my friends and neighbors throughout the district come out to celebrate veterans. The weather is beautiful. We got kids. We have senior citizens. And there's a feeling of unity and dare I say, hope even in thinking about what's best about this country. And it always motivates me as I head back to Washington for another week of tough negotiations.
All right. That is Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District. I hope you'll come back again soon to talk about those tough negotiations. But for now, thanks for joining us on Veterans Day.
Pleasure to be here.
And we'll play a little more music now from this morning's Veterans Day ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in the nation's capital. As we continue to mark this year's Veterans Day, we want to look back on America's longest war, the war in Afghanistan, and our painful, difficult exit from there earlier this summer. Back in August, when the horrific scenes of the U.S. withdrawal from the Kabul airport hit our TV screens, it really hit hard for veterans here, including those like John Velas, a state senator who served in Afghanistan in the summer of 2018, or Steve Xaros, a state representative and a Gold Star father. His oldest son, Nicholas, died on July 23, 2009, on the battlefield in Afghanistan. He was 21. Velas and Xaros spoke with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna back in August as the war came to a close and the Taliban returned to power. And they began with Senator Velas's push to get as many Afghan allies out as possible and how it felt for him to watch the scenes we all saw unfolding from the ground in Kabul.
Oh, it's tough. It's heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching. Some of the images that were flashed, you know, with the Taliban right outside of the U.S. Embassy, where I've spent a lot of time in Kabul, and then being at a table in the presidential palace, a place that I've been to many times, at that table, sitting down, having conversations with members of the Afghan government, trying to get to a place where we could have a peaceful resolution to Afghanistan and Afghans could live a great, prosperous life. To see the Taliban occupying that table and outside of our embassy, again, heart-wrenching to say the least. With respect to the people that are there, I just find it morally reprehensible, really is the only phrase that I could use to describe it, when you have so many people that did so many things for us. I mean, I was speaking to a linguist who is in Afghanistan right now, still obviously, and he was crying on the phone and he said, "I have been left behind." And he was explaining to me that the Taliban, as we were on the phone, were going around knocking on doors, you know, checking cell phones, checking paperwork. So, I mean, we have a moral obligation to get those individuals who helped us outside of that country.
So these folks who you fought alongside with, these Afghan allies, right, as you said, linguists, interpreters, anyone else who provided aid to the U.S. military or served in the Afghan government, you're the author of this letter to federal colleagues signed by some 70 Massachusetts legislators saying that we must make every effort to get our Afghan allies out. Have you heard from any of our delegation? What's the movement on that?
Yeah, I've been in constant conversations with members of the delegation in their offices. They get it. They understand it. I'm not 100% convinced that the average person back here in America, in Massachusetts, understands the true sacrifice of these linguists and cultural advisors. And kind of just to give you another example, I spoke with another linguist who I worked closely with back in 2012, 2013. And at the base that I was stationed at, it was FOB Smart. And right outside of that base on April 6, 2013, a day that will forever be kind of stitched in my mind, there was a foot patrol of U.S. service members, as well as obviously Afghan linguists, translators, and foreign service officers. In fact, the attack that ensued, which was a car bomb, three U.S. service members, the first foreign service officer, only foreign service officer that was killed in Afghanistan, Ann Smedinghoff, as well as an Afghan doctor. This linguist that I was talking to was on that foot patrol on April 6, 2013, and he got blown up, broke several bones in his body, and he's now living to tell the story. He has since been relocated here, but he's got family members over there. He's got fellow linguists over there. So these aren't people that stayed back on the base as U.S. service members kind of walked out and did their thing. They were right next to us, walking with us, unarmed, throughout the streets of Afghanistan. And you
serving
know, I always
with
say
you, really.
This, 100%. I firmly believe that we need to get all of these people out of this country.
So let's talk about sacrifice, Representative Xaros. Can we talk about your son, Nicholas, killed in action in 2009, served in the Marines in Afghanistan? And maybe you hear this a lot, but I do want to say it. I'm sorry for your loss.
Hey, thank you. These are tough times. But I just so impressed with Senator Velas. You know, we're talking with an American hero. So when he speaks with credibility. My son, Nick, you know, would have been someone like him. He loved his country. He was just a boy, you know, that like a lot of others that, you know, played baseball and football and He was the big brother to three others, you know, Ashlyn, Elizabeth, my twin daughters, and Alex, his little baby brother. He was like a big brother to everybody. And on September 11th, when we were attacked by these evil people, he was 13. And I remember the moment. A day later, we were walking through a supermarket, and he pulled me aside. He said, "Dad, I'm gonna be a Marine, and I'm gonna fight for our country." And you know, he was only 13, and I felt immediate like pride, but also worry. When he turned 17, he went to the recruiter, not them finding him. He went to their office, and you know, there's a moment I'll never forget when, almost like a movie scene, a Marine in the dress blues is sitting in my kitchen with my wife and I and, you know, 17-year-old Nick, and asking us to sign the papers because he was so young. My hand wouldn't move when I had the pen in my hand. And I signed those papers, and he went on to graduate high school. And a week later, he was at boot camp. And we couldn't wait to get letters from him. You know, they don't call home. They write letters. And we would wait by the mailbox. We were so proud. And we still are. And despite, you know, what's happening and what we see on, you know, it's so hurtful to me. I can't watch the news. Yeah. But as a dad, it's hard to watch.
If you could talk to Nicholas now about what's happening, what would you say to him?
I think he would say to me, he was very wise, because I'm not the type to sit on the sidelines. He would say to me, "Dad, let it go. Let it go. It's okay." And what I would say to him is, "I miss you, and I'm proud of you." And I know there's the greatest generation, but this is the next greatest generation. Senator Vilas, they volunteer. Every one of these young men and women from all walks of life, you know, and they volunteer to go. And so what I would tell him is, "I'm proud of you. And yes, I miss you, and it breaks my heart, but we focus on the good." And he never got to tell me about Afghanistan. He just screamed into the phone. He made one phone call, and he screamed in. He said, "Dad, I'm tired." And he fought in Iraq, you know, on the ground. He was infantry. And he said, "I just can't wait to come home. I'm tired." And he said, "It's really bad here." So they pushed out. That's called the Summer of Decision. Summer of 2009, President Obama sent 12,000 Marines to Afghanistan during the killing season, which is the summertime. And it was horrible. And Nick's battalion lost 14 men. But they're all brave, and we need to make sure that the ones that made it home know that their service was not in vain, that they helped free a country, they helped let women and children walk the streets, they set the tone for the future, that we are Americans and we will spill our blood all over the world and never take over a country, just put them back on their feet.
We should all be proud of your son. Representative, I also want to ask you what you've been hearing from other Gold Star families. Have you been talking to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I try to set them straight because, you know, we're all different. We all grieve differently. For me, it's been 12 years. When it first happened, I was suicidal. I wanted to be with my son. You know, and that's normal. and I'm not shy about that. That's a feeling. But we you know, you fight on. You find a purpose, and the purpose is to help others. And so what I try to tell them is, don't focus on, you know, the bad that we see. That will settle. Shame on the suits in Washington, not the boots on the ground. The boots on the ground did their job. So I try to tell other Gold Star families, stay proud of who you raised, and never let anyone take that away from you or us. That's the way it is. We stick together despite politics. Don't let that get in your way. We stick together. We raised American heroes.
Senator Velez, thinking too of the living, of those seeking refuge now, I'm wondering from your perspective what role Massachusetts should be and is playing in getting folks out, keeping folks safe from Afghanistan, both U.S. service members and Afghans.
I'd be remiss if I didn't just say this. You know, the rep used the word hero. Nicholas is a hero. His family is a hero. Gold Star families are the most precious asset we have in this world. You know, there's all this conversation about right now, you know, U.S. service members, you know, did we win the war? Did we lose the war? Was the sacrifice in vain? And I think that largely misses a point. You know, whatever's happening right now, to quote the rep, that's the suits in Washington, D.C. who did that. The suits have lost this war, not the service members. So what we need to do, you know, our obligation, we need to take care of the Gold Star families. And for those who are coming back with injuries, we do everything we can to take care of them and let them know that their sacrifice will never be in vain. And then we take certain steps, kind of revisiting the letter, to take care of our allies who walked those streets with us, who made it. So the efforts we put in, you know, that's not in vain. Again, the world is watching us. And make no mistake about it, what we do with our allies in Afghanistan right now is something that current, future adversaries are looking at. It. The world is watching us to see what we do right now.
So Representative Exaros, Senator Velez just said, you know, it was the suits in Washington who lost this war. Do you agree? And from your perspective, what is the lasting legacy of this war?
Great question. I don't like the sound of that we lost this war. You know, when Nick was killed horribly, it was horrible. But about a month later, President Obama and his wife flew to Cape Cod here and met with me and my wife and my three siblings, Nick's siblings. It wasn't just to shake hands, it was to talk. And he was very, you know, kind and compassionate. And I'll never forget talking with him. He hugged everybody. He said his kind words to my Alex and Elizabeth and Ashlyn and Lisa. And then he pulled me aside, man to man. And he said, I'm about to make my decision about Afghanistan. Now, this is August 2009. And the President of the United States said to me, what do you want me to do? And I told him, you keep fighting. You know, we don't give up. Keep fighting. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, when I make my decision, I will think of Nicholas.
So last question then, Senator Velez. What's next for U.S. service members and our legacy in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think, I just want to add, I was, you know, really the sentiment that I was expressing was, it wasn't U.S. service members that got us to the point we're at today. I would argue it's virtually impossible to say, did someone win or lose a war, particularly in a place like Afghanistan, such a hybrid environment where you're dealing with things like counterinsurgency, when you're dealing with coin doctrine, you're just dealing with so many things out there. I think what's next is, you know, we need to ensure that everybody is out of there that helped us. And then I think it really involves kind of sitting back and seeing, okay, what's next? What does the new Taliban government do? The message that I'm getting from the folks on the ground is don't believe a word they're saying.
John Velas, a state senator who served in Afghanistan in the summer of 2018, and Steve Exaros, a state representative and a Gold Star father, speaking with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna back in August. Since then, the Taliban has consolidated power in Afghanistan, and Velas's words are proving true. This isn't a new enlightened regime. Senator Velas tells us he's been able to help evacuate several translators, guides, family members safely since our troops left, but that the calls and emails for help continue to come in. And late last night at the State House, in the debate over how to spend the almost $4 billion from the American Rescue Plan Act, legislators carved out some $12 million to assist Afghan refugees in their resettlement here in the Commonwealth. Stay with us. For the rest of the hour, folks, we are going to discuss a subject that will be painful for many listeners. If you remember, you remember. It was a perfectly clear day on September 11th, 2001. American Airlines flight attendant Betty Ong made a call from Boston Flight 11 at about 8:19 a.m.
The cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class. And I think there's mates that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
5 minutes later, Boston Air Traffic Control hears this.
We have some planes. Just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We are turning to the airport.
And who's trying to call me here? American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody moves. Everything will be okay.
Of course, it wasn't going to be okay. Not by a long shot. A few minutes before 9 a.m., Katie Couric tells the nation.
We have a breaking news story to tell you about. Apparently, a plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened just a few moments ago, apparently. We have very little information available.
17 minutes later, at 9:03 a.m., United Airlines Flight 175 from Boston slammed into the South Tower live on television.
So you have no idea right now?
Oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Right? Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. My God, it's right in the middle of the building.
We all remember where we were that morning, and Virginia Buckingham was on her way to work. She was listening to WBZ News Radio and was headed to Logan, where she ran Massport to also catch a flight. And she will never forget the words her director of communication called to tell her, two planes are off the radar. That day and the days that followed changed our country forever. We mourned the lives lost in New York, Boston, Washington, Pennsylvania. America marched to war. But in those first few days, Virginia Buckingham was changed too. Locally, in some media circles, she became the public face of the tragedy, blamed for the security failures at Logan, run out of her job. She's spent the last 20 years since 9/11 carrying that pain, the guilt, the public blame, and she tells that story in her new memoir, On My Watch. Virginia Buckingham joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's hard for me to hear all that sound again. I can't imagine what it's like for you. How are you reacting to revisiting that day, both today and this year on this huge anniversary?
It's just as horrifying, just as surreal as it felt then. And I'm struck after listening to the interview right before this one with the veteran and the dad, how the ramifications of that day just go on and on and on, and the pain it caused go on and on.
You know, there's so much to this book. I almost don't know how to tell listeners what it is, because it is the arc of pain of 20 years. And Virginia, there were times when I almost felt like I shouldn't be reading it, like it was too much of your pain for me to be partaking in. And yet you chose to write this story now. What moved you to put it on paper after these, you know, 20 years?
I just wanted to make some meaning out of it, I think, and offer it to readers who are going through their own painful transformations. And certainly my story is different, but everyone has a story and a story of loss in their lives. And I guess I hoped that my story would help others.
What do our stories mean? Are they what define us? Are they how other people understand us? What does your story mean?
For me, it means a few things that I hope resonate with others. And first and foremost, I talk about the destructiveness of blame. You know, I was singled out almost right away here in Boston by some in media, some politicians. And I think it was because people were so afraid and so angry that they needed to put their fear and anger somewhere. And I was an easy target for that. But it certainly doesn't do anything to solve any problem. It didn't make Logan Airport any safer. And so I hope readers take that away and other leaders who might read my story take that away. And also, I think I show through my book that you can move forward and build a new life after something horrific. But you can't move on, and you do carry those scars with you, and that's part of life too. And I think too often we want to kind of slam the door on the past and not acknowledge that we carry our painful parts along with our joyful parts.
I want to ask you now to read a little bit of something from very early in the book. It's on page 8 from the 2006 deposition you gave. Do you mind reading that little bit for us?
Sure. The attorney, who was to be my chief questioner, represented about 25 of the passengers who went through Logan checkpoints on September 11th and their families. He sat directly to my right and introduced himself. After a few formalities, he wasted no time in going for the jugular. Before 9/11, did you know who Al-Qaeda was? Did you know who Osama bin Laden was? Did you know terrorists had issued fatwas against the U.S.? I answered each question quietly. No. I knew that most Americans before 9/11 would have answered the same way I did. Yet inside, the despair that had been my closest companion in the years since 9/11 immediately enveloped me in response to the lawyer's insinuation. I should have known.
That's Virginia Buckingham reading from her new memoir, On My Watch. You know, we asked for that passage because in much of the book it seemed like folks blamed you, and then sometimes you blamed you, and sometimes you were angry at being blamed, sometimes you were tortured by your worry that it was your fault, and sometimes you wanted everybody to be clear-eyed that it wasn't. And I think that's probably where the full range of our listeners are today, Virginia. Some from that time who may still blame you, some who can't conceive of how the head of Massport might be responsible for 9/11. Where are you today, and what have you learned about blame itself?
You know, most people don't know that the checkpoints, which was the point of security that these terrorists used at all four airports where they boarded planes, were under the purview of the airlines. And I don't blame the airlines, certainly, because no one conceived that terrorists would use small knives and go through security that wouldn't have been detected and were in many cases legal anyway, and hijack planes and use the planes as weapons. But I lost that clarity myself, and I stopped hearing my own voice that knew that was the case and that knew this was a worldwide attack that couldn't have been prevented, at least not at my level, because the voices of blame were so loud and so strong. And I considered myself so capable and such a leader that I felt I should have known. And I got kind of lost in that. And that kind of seed of guilt lived in my heart and my soul for a long, long time until I started listening to my own voice again. And I stopped looking for external exoneration. That's another important thing. I wanted someone, anyone, the president, the Globe, to say it wasn't my fault. And even though the courts did, even though the 9/11 commission did, none of that mattered unless I could listen to my own voice. And I think the power of blame stops you from really being clear about what is true. And it's so important to hold on to what is true.
What would you say today to those who are still angry and still blame you?
I'm angry, too, that terrorists did this to our country. And I am heartbroken, too, over the pain that so many families have experienced. And it's just not true that Massport could have stopped it, that I could have stopped it. And I understand the wanting it to be true, because that would feel so much safer than the reality that life is fragile and we live in a very dangerous world. That's very hard to think about and wrap your arms around. I understand it, but blaming doesn't make it better.
So I wanted to spend some time in that tight space, Virginia, around the date, around the blame, around where you are with that today, acknowledging those who may come at this conversation as listeners from a lot of different places. But now I want to step back on the book a little bit, because it felt also like a Rorschach test. If you wanted to read a book about women in leadership, it's there. If you wanted to read a book about politics and scapegoating, it's there. If you wanted to read a book about motherhood and family and marriage, it's there. I really want to dive into all of those. One of the things that struck me is a lot of people didn't show up for you. And then some people did, who really surprised you, came from unusual places, like the Boston Herald, even after there were others at the Boston Herald who blamed you. So talk a little bit about who really showed up for you and what that meant to you.
It's one of the remarkable parts of my story that I'm so grateful for, is the kindness and compassion that I was shown from unlikely places. And one of those first places was at the Herald, where I was interested in going to work after I left Massport, despite their harsh coverage, because I wanted to be a writer. And some of my fellow journalists weren't too happy about that and signed a petition saying it was wrong for the Herald to hire me. And my boss, her name is Rochelle Cohen, she's now at the Globe, she crumbled that petition up in a ball and gave me a chance to do what I had wanted to do my whole life, actually, which was be a professional writer. So she was a hero in her kindness and compassion. And similarly, there is a mom that I reached out to whose daughter died on United 175. Her name is Anne McFarlane from Revere. Her daughter is Mary Ann. And I reached out to her and asked her if she blamed me, because I think I needed to hear from a family member directly what they really thought. And she looked right at me and she said, "You're no more to blame than my daughter Mary Ann is. And I want you to go live your life in Mary Ann's name." And that kindness and compassion was a life raft I held on to for many, many, many years.
So I want to pick up another piece of the Rorschach test, which is that you were a woman leader. It was 2001. You were taking on a troubled organization in Massport. It was already famed for the booze cruise, for being a place of political patronage. You were accused of being a subject of political patronage and receiving the job. We just talked about people who showed up for you. There were people who came after you. And as I read the book, I wondered if they would have come after a man in the same way. If you were vulnerable at that time by your gender, and I'm projecting, I was the first woman leader of an organization in that same decade, so maybe I'm just projecting, but I do want to ask you, were you more vulnerable? Was there a target on your back because you were a girl?
You know, I get asked that all the time, and I wish I had a clear answer, but I don't. You know, I was 36. When 9/11 happened, it strikes me that that's the same age as our new mayor-elect, Michelle Wu, who also has two little children. I had a child and was pregnant with the other. You know, if Massport was a political football, do I think it would have happened if a man was there? Probably. Maybe not to the same extent, but probably. And you got to remember, the acting governor who essentially forced me to resign was a woman, too.
Jane Swift.
It's hard to say.
I do want to name Jane Swift, who our listeners know here. She's on somewhat regularly. And I do want to take that on for a second, because it feels to me in the book like you were disappointed that she didn't show up for you.
You know, I have a long career in politics, and I understand how politics works. I just didn't expect that politics would be the first resort after a worldwide attack on our country. And I do understand the tough job Jane Swift had to do at the time. I just feel she didn't rise to the occasion that was required to come out and say, look, you can say it was mass work, because mass port's a political football. I get it, but it's just not true. And she chose to go a different route.
And I want to acknowledge here that every one of these threads we're picking up, we could go down, right, for another hour. There is another thread here on this that I want to pick up on, which is this reform. So you sound a lot of notes about security in airports, management of Logan, of Massport. You don't seem satisfied to me at the end of the book that we've learned all the lessons we should have and made the changes that we should have. Nor do you seem satisfied that you had focused as much on security as maybe you felt you should have in retrospect. So where are we today? And are you satisfied with the changes that we've made?
No, I'm very, very proud that Logan Airport led the way to fighting to make airport security real after 9/11. And I'll never forget being on a call in those first days after 9/11 with the head of the FAA and a bunch of airport directors from around the country. And they were all talking about, you know, how are we going to get, you know, our sports teams onto planes without having to go through security? Like, they were stuck in the past as if this hadn't even happened, which might be an unfair statement, but it made me really angry. And, you know, we as an airport fought to turn the checkpoints over to what is now the TSA. I think we're the only airport that advocated for that. We instituted a behavioral screening program that is still in place today and is a pilot around the country to look for behavior, not just weapons. So I think that we like to gripe about the inconvenience of what has changed in airport security. It needs to continue to evolve as the threats continue to evolve. You know, there are people who are targeting our country who are sitting out there considering how they can do it given the current security situation. I hope they can't. But I think we have to always be pushing forward to be on top of it and ahead of it.
I want to ask you one more question, and I have to ask you to keep your answer short. We have less than a minute. The main leadership lesson that you've taken 20 years later.
Do not blame when things go wrong. Find a solution. Tell citizens the truth about what is facing them, even if it's scary. And do not blame. Solve the problem.
And that is Virginia Buckingham, former head of Massport and author of the new memoir, On My Watch. Virginia, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show on this Veterans Day. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wolfman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.